there's something undefinable that beckons travelers back to the greater Fort Myers area in southwest Florida year after year. It feels like bare feet on soft white sand beaches that give way to gently lapping waves. It looks like the breathtaking abundance of wildlife, colorful birds, dolphins, manatees, and more, dwelling in lush mangrove ecosystems and translucent Gulf waters. It tastes like fresh coastal cuisine served at sunset at a waterfront restaurant. What will draw you back to Fort Myers? Go to visitfortmyers.com for more inspiration.
Hello, everyone. I'm Gilbert Cruz, and this is the Book Review Podcast. This year marks the 50th anniversary of a cult artifact called Wisconsin Death Trip. It's quite a dark read. It's a book filled with death, despair, arson, suicide, and madness. And I'm joined today by Time staff critic Dwight Garner, who's written a wonderful look back at the book. Now, if this doesn't sound like your bag, if it's too grim or what have you, we totally understand. The Book Review Podcast will be here next week with lighter fare. But for those of you for whom this sounds somewhat intriguing, please stay with us as we discuss Wisconsin Death Trip. Dwight, welcome. Thank you for being here.
Hey, Gilbert. It's good to be back.
So I'm ashamed, maybe, to say that I had never heard of this book before. Clearly, it is one that many people have. And when it came out in 1973, it seems like it was a pretty big deal. For those of us listening who don't know about Wisconsin Death Trip, what is it?
It's sort of a passion project. This young academic, a then young academic named Michael Lessie, was at the University of Wisconsin in the early 70s, and he stumbled upon this archive of thousands of photographs taken by a small-town photographer in Black River Falls, Wisconsin. And the photographer's name was Charles Van Schaick. And Van Schaick was not a art photographer of any sort. He just worked commercially. But when he looked through these photos, Lessie, there were thousands of them, Lessie just felt some connection to them. They're kind of very dark. They're very formal in the way that photographs were then, because it was a formal process. Cameras were large. People rarely smiled for photographs. But there was something else going on. A lot of them were kind of dark. Some of them were of babies in caskets and that sort of thing. And he realized that he had found something. By the way, these photographs were taken between 1890 and 1910. And he then went to some other archives and went through old newspapers during that same period in and around Black River Falls. And he found this sort of remarkable series of documents. Every day in the newspaper, there seemed to be someone going mad or throwing themselves in front of a train. It was a time of, they'd just gotten through a depression in the 1890s. And he found all these small news items and he prints them. It's just a series of news items printed that run alongside these photographs. And the combination of them is overpowering.
One of the things that strikes me about this book is its structure, of course, but also I can't remember the last thing I read that evoked such a trance-like mood in me. I read, usually at night, these chapters, and I'd go through these snippets, and you just read one, and they're short, and then you read another, and they're short, and they're all pretty grim. And sooner or later, you find yourself in this mood that is undeniable. And it's not easy in a book to evoke a mood. Not that this is a stereotypical book or even a book in the sense that we think of books.
I think it evokes that period. I said something similar in the piece that I've written about it, that evokes what sort of long nights felt like in America before there was electricity and radio. And before, if your child was very sick, there were no antibiotics. Maybe your child is dying. And anxiety, of course, cannot be treated then by antidepressants or other kind of pills. And people, quote unquote, went mad more often than we'd like to think. And there were bankruptcies, people threw themselves in front of trains. There are all kinds of suicides in this book. And it just makes you wonder what was happening, what kind of spiritual crisis was going on in Wisconsin in the 1890s.
I described this in the introduction as a cult artifact. Is that accurate?
I think that's true. It's kind of bubbled under the radar. It's influenced a certain number of filmmakers. I say in my piece that the new Cormac McCarthy novel, has two new ones out this fall, but the second of them, Stella Maris, is set in a psychiatric hospital. And it happens to be in Black River Falls, the same town where this book is set. And I don't think that's any accident. I think that, you know, McCarthy has been known to give away copies of this book to friends. He loves the book. It adds an extra level of darkness to McCarthy's novel to know that.
As you said, there are lots of snippets of newspaper reports. A lot of the text in the book is drawn from a couple of key sources. So one, this local newspaper, two, records from the local mental hospital, and three, town gossip.
There's some oddities to this book. Lessie was an interesting guy, and he took some liberties. You know, a few occasions he collages the photographs. He sort of turns them this way and that. And in other occasions, he seems to have made up, or he has made up, some mythical voices for this book. There's a town gossip and a historian that their voices, they're very small parts of the book, but they're coming from Lessie's own voice that he's added to it. So it's a weird brew he's working at here. And I read in my review, I don't think those parts work very well. At least they don't work very well 50 years later. But what really works are the photographs, which are unbelievably striking. And I have one of the news items right here. I mean, they tend to be like this, very short. Like, a woman was recently found wandering about the streets of Eau Claire with a dead baby in her arms. She was from Chippewa County and had lost her husband and was destitute. And basically, it's just item upon item that kind of reads like that. Most of these items are about people being admitted into institutions or committing suicide or losing everything. There's a lot of arson. And there's a lot of items in this book about entire families who have like seven children, all of them dying in the course of 3 days from diphtheria. And it's just heartbreaking. And you flip back and forth between these items and the photographs, and it's really powerfully unnerving.
Before you came up with the idea to write this 50th anniversary piece, when was the last time that you had revisited this book? And was there anything that stuck out to you this time?
It had been 30 years, really, since I'd had it last. And when I picked it up, I kind of felt, you know, those kind of Spielbergian or Kubrick-like zoom shots where you're kind of zooming in and pulling away at the same time. So the book gives you that kind of vertigo, and I felt that when I picked it up again. And, you know, I'm a big fan of unusual documentary projects. I mean, one of my favorite books is James A.G. and Walker Evans' book, Let Us Not Praise Famous Men, which, as you know, has these photographs by Walker Evans, which are very simple in many ways and very classically framed, while A.G.'s text is this howl of pain. It's all about art and the way we should look at underprivileged people. And it's this wild, intellectualized text. So it's a very strange book of documentary, which I revere. And I revere this book in a way. It came out of it's a very personal kind of vision. I feel like this guy found these photographs. A lot of them were decaying. If he hadn't found them, a lot of them would never be seen ever again. And he had the wits to go and think, how can I improve on this? What can I do with these photographs? And he found this text.
Talk to me about the old weird America, which means a lot of different things. But in your piece, you talk about having a conversation or an exchange with Grail Marcus about this book.
Grail Marcus, the great rock critic, has written for me in the past, and I don't really know him well. We've had one meal together, but once in a while he'll send me an email. And he's a very perceptive guy, and he read my review of the Cormac McCarthy novel, the last one, Stella Maris, and said, Dwight, you didn't pick up on the fact that that book is set in Black River Falls, Wisconsin, where American Death Trip is set. And as soon as he said that, I just went, oh, because often as a critic, a reference will blow past you and you only realize it a week later. It's kind of like leaving the party, the cocktail party, after someone vaguely insulted you and the perfect remark only comes to you in the elevator, you know, and that happens to critics. You know, we remember the perfect thing sometimes a little bit down the line. And that was the case here. But it's worth mentioning Grail Marcus because it's his phrase, of course, the old weird America, which he applied to a book that he wrote about the basement tapes, Bob Dylan and the band, and talked about how they tapped into these weird old American spirits of old-timey musicians and old-timey ways of being. And America before it was felt so entirely pasteurized that its culture did. And all these guys who played music who still had mud on their boots. This book is very much in that old weird American vein. As I said before, it puts me in mind of Springsteen's album Nebraska in a lot of ways. It predated that by a decade. And it's in line with these stripped-down American products, of which the basement tapes were as well.
One of the things that stuck out to me as someone who grew up in a big city was, to me at least, it sort of reinforced how dangerous rural life can be. There's a strain in American culture and American life and maybe American politics that likes to valorize rural life as more real, perhaps. Of course, this was more than 100 years ago. There's a vast amount of space out there in America. And just because someone lives in rural America doesn't mean they are safer, that they are more immune from despair, from mental health, from disease, from all the things that you see in this book here.
No, it's true. Actually, this book sort of highlights this loneliness that can get to you when you're out in the middle of nowhere, especially before there were telephones and there was radio. The nights were very long indeed. And I can only imagine, I mean, all of us, I'm sure all the listeners and myself and everyone have had nights in their lives when something just dreadful had happened to them. Or you were deeply worried about something, a friend who has an illness or something you have to do tomorrow. Maybe you've made a mistake at work, something that you're really upset about. And back in this period, those kind of things could fester. I mean, you had no one to talk to. Like I said, there weren't as many outlets. And if you were living alone or out in the middle of nowhere, there are all kinds of fears. And one of the fears that comes up in this book, too, are he calls them, the newspaper men of the time called them tramps. But there were men living in the woods who would sometimes get together and attack these small towns. He writes a lot about families and that had been raided in the night and people hurt or killed and places burned down and wild howling voices coming from the woods from these quote-unquote tramps. And also, there was a lot of religious mania that went on. Farmers reported seeing huge reptilian beasts in rivers carrying away their shrieking farm animals more than once. And it just makes you wonder what drove these kind of visions.
The new Starz series, Mary and George, starring Julianne Moore and Nicholas Galitzine, tells a story almost too outrageous to be true. But shockingly, it is. With next to nothing to her name and looking to elevate her social standing, Mary Villiers sets her handsome and charming son George on the path to seduce King James I and become his all-powerful lover. The show is full of wit, scandal, action. You won't be able to look away. Watch the season premiere of Mary and George now, only on Starz and the Starz app.
My name is Thomas Gibbsneff. I'm a journalist at the New York Times. I served in the Marine Corps as an infantryman. When it comes to reporting on the front line, a lot of the same basics are at play. You're looking at the map of where you're going. If you're on a paved road, field roads, you know, is there a hospital nearby? Is your body armor affixed with the first aid kit? Does everyone know where that first aid kit is? We arrive into a military position. I get out of the car. I look at my watch. You know, I set a timer, no more than an hour. I'm listening for drones, jets, check in with the team. Is everyone comfortable? And if they are, then we proceed. Frontline reporting is dangerous, but I think nothing is more important than talking to the people involved, you know, hearing their stories and being able to connect that with people thousands of miles away. Anything that can make something like this more personal, I think, is well worth the risk. New York Times subscribers make it possible for us to keep doing this vital coverage. If you'd like to subscribe, you can do that at nytimes.com/subscribe.
Welcome back, everyone. I'm here with Dwight Garner, and we are discussing the book, Wisconsin Death Trip. And I just needed to read one of my favorite tiny excerpts from this book. Alexander Gardapi, aged 90 years, died at Prairie du Chien. He walked into a saloon, drank a glass of gin, asked the time of day, sat down, and died.
As ways to go. Maybe that's how I'd like to go.
It's very, what's his name at the White Horse Tavern? I can't remember.
Dylan Thomas.
Dylan Thomas, yeah. 12 whiskeys, I've had enough, walks out and dies. That, honestly, is one of the lighter excerpts I could pull. Because as you said, there's so many children that die in here from diphtheria, which was going around at the time. So many people who take their own lives. So many people whose houses burn down either as the result of arson, what they called incendiaries at the time, or other reasons. And I'd like to talk about tone a little bit because I read a bunch of these. And just as I did, and maybe you just did some of them, you laugh. Because it is darkly humorous, but at the same time, you understand that this was the worst thing that ever happened to this particular person in this excerpt. As you're going through this book, I'm wondering if you could walk me through how you're dealing with tones as a critic, how you're thinking about how those things are balanced, because this is a constructed product. This is not something that this gentleman wrote on his own. He put together a collage. It's sort of a verbal montage.
There are only a few. There's maybe 8 to 10 entries out of you know, hundreds that feel comic in tone. And you remember them because some of them are indeed kind of funny. But in general, he goes for stuff that shows people in distress. As I write in my piece, a cynic would say about this book that you could go through any old newspaper really of the time, probably, and find a fair number of horrible deaths. I mean, they were reported then in a way that newspapers don't report on that kind of thing anymore. We don't read a lot about suicides anymore. We read about them if it's a college student or if it's someone famous. But in general, newspapers, and of course, newspapers in America have been gutted out. You don't have small town papers like this in many places anymore that have real staffs who report on this stuff. There's a kind of reporting in this book that is sort of the crazy death that we don't read about anymore. The person at the sawmill who gets tangled up. Maybe you'll read about it somewhere. But there was more of a staple of small town news reporting then. Even in papers like the New York Times did a lot of that. Our colleague Tina Jordan has culled some of this stuff from the New York Times archive. She shared some of it with me the other day. But in general, what Leslie is after is stuff that almost suggests, as I said before, a kind of spiritual crisis. So many people having breakdowns. And it just makes you realize that our nostalgia for the good old American heartland, there's a real dark shadow there. And in many ways, it's false nostalgia. And this book is one of those correctives that puts you in touch with the night side of life in this way that few books of documentary that I've read actually do.
Did you have occasion to read our original review of this book?
Yeah, I did read them. There were two reviews. One was by William Gass in the Sunday Book Review, and one was by Christopher Lehman Haupt in the Daily.
I was quite taken by William Gass's review, both because he is who he is, but also because there were some choice lines in it. And I wanted to read one quote because it does relate to something you just said here. He wrote, "But it is poetry all the same, a construction. For couldn't we put together our own death trip out of any batch of local papers? There would be a different ratio of deaths due to X rather than to Y, to be sure, a difference which is vital. But the total picture might be equally grim, or with the right shears, made to seem so anywhere. Perhaps human misery can neither be created nor destroyed, merely transformed, distributed, endured."
I love it. You know, it's funny. You know, I grew up in two places. I grew up in Charleston, West Virginia, and in Naples, Florida. And Naples, Florida is such a sunny, postcard-like place. At least that's the image it wants to present to the world. That part of me, there's nothing I would love more to read about my quasi-hometown of Naples, Florida, than for some historian to do something similar like this. I mean, there are one or two things that I know about in Naples where people have gone back, for example, and done things about the African-American population of that town, which is really, it's a long, weird story down there. You know, this is the kind of book that I wish there were more or few of. I would like to read one for Naples, Florida, and some other places. And William Gass said correctly that anyone could have done this, but anyone didn't. Michael Lessie did it, and it worked. It may not work in a lot of towns. It's, for some reason, Wisconsin at the time was ripe for this kind of material.
I was wondering, Dwight, if you had another snippet or two that stood out to you.
I mean, you know, they're all like this. They're all about the length of a short poem, you know, like a K. Ryan poem. They're all about 25 words, most of them. But here's one. "Poverty and no work caused August Schultz of Appleton to shoot himself in the head while sitting in his little home with his wife and five children." This was on 9/24 from the newspaper. It doesn't give a year. In this case, I've forgotten what the year was, but he gives the years in the book. Another one is, "The malignant diphtheria epidemic in Lewis Valley, La Crosse County, proved fatal to all the children in Martin Malloy's family, five in number. Three died in a day. The house and furniture were burned." I have a line in my review, a line that W.H. Auden wrote in 1948. He said, "There are events which arouse such simple and obvious emotions that an AP cable or a photograph in Life magazine are enough and poetic comment is impossible." And I'd say these kind of items, you know, this the idea of a whole family dying in a day and having to burn their house and furniture. I mean, that basically is what Auden is talking about. There's what else? What can you say? These things are these small, very black moments in the culture, which somehow he layers them and builds them towards something that uses these tiny, awful things to build a portrait of the other side of life in Wisconsin at the time that's just really undeniable.
Well, and to tell the truth, it really has been a while, if ever, that I've come across a work, a book, a work of art, if this can be called that, that did the very basic job of reminding me that that I too will die one day.
I know just what you're talking about. It's the kind of book that makes you realize there's a skeleton in your hand. You know, I forget where this phrase comes from. And somewhere in the literature of the documentary, someone talks about documents of feeling. And this book on some level is a document of feeling. It takes you to this place. It makes you consider the dark side of what it's like to be alive. Susan Sontag called illness, I think, the dark side of life. And this is the dark side of life writ large. And it's the side of life that's really all around us all the time. Michael Lessie happened to sort of grab it and concentrate it and move it into concentrated form. And he made this book that's just like holding a bit of nuclear radiation.
I could say that it would be, as we've alluded to, easy to go through newspapers and pull a bunch of stuff together. But I cannot imagine the art that went into just the right number of excerpts, putting the right ones next to each other, choosing the right photos, even though Lessie did not write this book. He did not take these photos. It is an act of creation that is unique and sort of unparalleled.
Yeah, he makes the point in the book that the photographer we've talked about wasn't any sort of artist. He had no pretension in his work, and yet the photographs are beautiful and haunting nonetheless. There was a father and son team that wrote most of the articles that appeared in the small town paper that he excerpts here. And then the things that I've, the two excerpts that I've read or three are from that. And he writes that these were just workaday journalists. These stories were nothing new to them. They wrote these dispatches and they moved on to the next thing. And yet over time, you realize that this father and son team were, their prose is direct and it's filled with something. You know, William Murrow said he would tell the radio people during the bombing of London, you know, never shout, never sound emotional because that will ruin your reporting. And there's something of that in the way these stories are written because they're, the horror is just left there in front of you. They do nothing to egg it up. You know, there's no attempt to make anything seem worse than it was. They just lay it there in front of you. And somehow the simplicity of the writing makes everything even more horrifying.
To that point, Henry Ehlers, a Milwaukee butcher, died from nosebleed. His nose had been bleeding for 9 days. He was 37 years of age and had been a great meat eater.
Well, you know, I wouldn't mind that on my tombstone. We already have two ways for me to die tonight. I want to walk into a bar at age 90, order a shot and die, and then have he was a great meat eater on his tombstone. No, you're finding the funny ones. You're stumbling upon them.
I know. I just cannot read out the most tragic stories in here.
It no, really it's is. True. It's true. I mean, we've talked about it. I mean, with incest, you know, howling wild men in the woods, axe murders. It's funny. I don't know a great deal about the quote unquote Great Depression of the 1890s, but historians have written about it, and it's a less talked about American depression. But he does, throughout this book, talk a lot about banks that failed and about businesses that failed and people who went without work for a very long time and who were hungry. People have talked about what it's like to live during the Great Depression. One of the things they say about it was that it wasn't like you went and you saw a lot of suffering. What it felt like was just a kind of emptiness. You know, the streets were empty in a way that was almost like the COVID time. And in a way, when you read books about what's happening in Ukraine, it's very similar there now. There's an emptiness to things. And there was a kind of emptiness that's hinted at in this book. People just aren't going out as much. There's no work. People are staying home and they're with nothing to eat and no jobs and banks collapsing. There's a lot of bank runs in this book. Just a sense of life coming apart at the seams.
Listeners, I will give you a preview. We're definitely going to rerun this episode come Halloween time. So,
well, you know a good deal about, you know, you're a scholar of the genre of horror. And horror is an interesting word because it covers a lot of material. I mean, literature, film, I'm sure it covers to some degree documentary.
One of the things it reminded me the most of, maybe in a very unsophisticated way, but because of the dry way in which it was written, because of the flat affect, again, not purposeful, just the way they were writing it, was some of the books of Edward Gorey. There is a very straightforward, unadorned way of describing terrible or mysterious things. And when you put a lot of those next to each other, it builds up again to a hypnotic effect. The other amazing thing about this book is really how much it shines a light on how little we knew about mental health at the end of the 1890s and the early 1900s. I mean, there's so many cases in here of people apparently suffering from depression, despair, genuine mental illness, and they just did not know how to treat it. They didn't know what to do with them. It's really heartbreaking.
They would throw you in the house, you know. Yeah. And it happened to women especially. I mean, of course, this is no secret to anyone, but quote unquote hysteria, it was diagnosed, any kind of unusual ailment or affliction was often pinned down to something like hysteria. And women more than men were thrown in psychiatric hospitals. So it's really, you feel that in this book. A lot of women more than men go mad in this book. And you sort of realize that that's partly just pure discrimination.
So Dwight, one of the things I'd love to do, just to cut the tension here, is get a sense of something wonderful and upbeat that you've read or watched or listened to recently.
Well, Gilbert, when I want to relax, I've said this before, I think somewhere, maybe in the same room, but when I relax at night, I like to read cookbooks. And you know, I have a lot of them because I've just collected them over the years, and I'm a sort of a big reader in food literature. And there's a new cookbook out. There's a wonderful restaurant. Some listeners may have heard of it. It's in the West Village. It's called Via Carrata, and it's an Italian restaurant. It's gotten really hip. It's hard to get into now. I can barely get into it now. I used to be able to get into it. I still can, but I have to work harder to get in. And they have a new cookbook out. I think Random House did it. It's just filled with lovely recipes that are pretty simple to make. I mean, some of them are hard enough. The text is excellent, and the restaurant is so homey and well-run and rustic. It makes you feel better about being alive just to walk into Via Carrata. And the cookbook gives me some of the same vibes.
Dwight, thank you so much for being here and talking about this very bizarre, utterly memorable book.
Thanks, Gilbert. My pleasure.
That was our conversation with Dwight Gardner on the occasion of the 50th anniversary of Wisconsin Death Trip. I'm Gilbert Cruz, editor of the New York Times Book Review. Thank you for listening.
When everyone is on the same page, getting things done is easy. Make a bigger impact at work with Grammarly. Grammarly is your secure AI writing partner that enables your team to make their point and move faster. You can even save time by going from spending hours editing drafts to just seconds. Join the 96% of Grammarly users that say it helps them craft more impactful writing. Sign up and download Grammarly for free at grammarly.com/podcast. That's grammarly.com/podcast. Easier said. Done.